You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right. Now.
The club isn't the best place to find the lovers, so the bar is where I go. Me and my friends at the table doing shots, drinking fast and then we talk slow.
Good morning, Newsom. Welcome to All Marine Radio.
Okay, hi, yeah.
How's everything in the Hawaiian Islands?
Well, okay. Mm-hmm. It's going to kind of windy, but the rain stopped, so it's pretty good.
Isn't that normal for your neck of the woods? That's why you live on a tropical Pacific paradise?
Kind of, but it's just been raining a lot this winter, so... more than usual, but I think it's back to normal for a few days at least.
All right. I just want to update you on, I think you're going to have a little bit of a problem in the National League East this year. I think the New York Mets are going to be a pretty good baseball team. They seem to have cleared up their personnel issues, and they played some pretty good games against your Washington Senators. And very entertaining baseball. So, I hadn't seen him play this spring, and I was very impressed. I think they have I think they're pretty impressive. So.
Well, I think you're right. You could be the being a Senators fan that you kind of go into a season expecting the worst. So nothing. So this would be no surprise. But we'll see.
I don't mean to conjure up ghosts or anything like that. I wasn't attempting to do that. I was just making a comment on the Mets. They look like they're better than, you know, the Mets have had great pitching, but everybody's been hurt for the last few years. I want to do this publicly. I was talking earlier that you have, I've learned a lot since I started doing this show 2 years ago. I've learned a ton about post-traumatic stress, what it is, what it's not, and behind that, I've learned a lot about transitioning. But I would say if you take those two issues off, the next two things about topics that I've learned a ton about, number one, Vietnam. Vietnam is so different, so complex. It's such a different war depending on if you were in Northern I Corps or on the coast near Da Nang, and what year you were there. It tends to be very different, and the way those guys got treated and the stories that they tell. It's been a wonderful education for me. Right behind Vietnam is the Pacific Rim. And you are the chief educator of those of us here on All Marine Radio. And I have been, I have now become sensitized. In fact, I have a permanent Google search in my phone that says South China Sea on it. And so everything related to the Pacific Rim is kind of caught in there. And I just find it fascinating reading. And it also leads me to consistently scratching my head because I don't see an American initiative designed to push back against the Chinese. I see a fragmented and inattentive United States that focuses at times on North Korea, at times on China, at times on the South China Sea, at times on trade, but not an overarching policy. At least it doesn't seem to come through to me. And I want to thank you for not only the headache that it gives me as I read that, but also the education. So thank you very much.
Oh, anytime. I'm glad to do it. That's a big topic, and there's always something new coming. Plus, it's so vast that nobody understands it all.
Well, to me, one of the things you sensitized me to is the predatory nature of China's approach. What do they call it? Their Roads and Belt Initiative? Is that what they call
Belt
it?
Belt Road, yeah.
One Belt, One Road. And so they loan money around the world. It's not aid, it's their loans. And if you default on your payments, they'll take over your port or your airport and that's what you agree to. But in the places that they've gone to offer this, for instance, a Western route out of internal China to through Pakistan to blue water is something that the Chinese believe they absolutely need to decrease their own dependence on their own eastern seaboard. And so you look at this, and then I think, well, who are they, is it Pavudu?
It's a place called Vanuatu.
There you go, Vanuatu. They're to the east of the Philippines, that they're trying to negotiate a naval base, a permanent naval base, a lease there. And if you're one of those small on your ass nations, and the Chinese say, "Hey, here's what we'll pay, here's what we're willing to do," why do you say no to that? Right? The Americans, the Australians haven't been interested. We're sitting out here in the middle of no place. Why wouldn't I let the Chinese create Guantanamo base out there and have it to themselves?
That's pretty much the dynamic. You know, it's not that complicated. These are island nations that don't have much going for them. You know, they've really got very weak economies, if that, mostly right. Dependent on, say, one thing, if that. And so somebody shows up with a ton of money and particularly is willing to throw it around nominally for the country writ large, but also to make sure that the leaders get a nice cut themselves. Of course, people are going to say yes. And I think what you've touched on earlier is the lack of attention from the United States government. But down in South Pacific, the Australians and the New Zealanders have been similarly inattentive. And the idea has always been that, well, we do what in everything we've been doing, that's good enough, and which means, oh, say in the U.S. military's case, we might send a ship by once in a while. We do a medical program, might have the band come ashore and play something. We may do a SME or something. And then there's always the favorite, the key leader engagement, where you send a general or an admiral down, and he goes around and, you know, looks around, you know, he meets the leaders there, meets the head of the militaries. They have a dinner and they declare themselves best friends, and that's it. You know, somehow our flag officers are supposed to have some sort of magic power that attracts friends and keeps them forever. But these are just formal. These don't really amount to much. And if you're on the receiving side, what would you rather have? Something like 500 million Chinese dollars or a visit by the deputy commanding general of U.S. Army Pacific, or take your, you know, yeah, take your command. And it is, the dynamic is about that simple. It doesn't require, you know, any great academic expertise to figure it out. And like you said, to understand the Chinese, it's like a really big, aggressive mafia in many respects. And that's a good way to understand it. It's also, part of it is the Chinese idea that, you know, they just want stuff to want it. Plus, there's a belief that if the Chinese are involved in everything, it makes it bigger and better, and they've just got to be involved. And that's not well understood. It's just part of the character, sort of like being Texans.
You know what's astounding to me as I've followed as you've sensitized me and I've read on it is, you know, the whole 9-dash line event in the South China Sea is a complete fabrication based on what they want and then the natural resources and the first boundary in terms of Chinese, the Chinese building it, starting in the South China Sea, ultimately, and we'll get this will transition us towards the Japanese and their Marine Corps and what's next. But I mean, ultimately, that's moving to the East China Sea, and that's the initial belt of Chinese defense. And then there's a further a belt further to the west, and we're starting to see that is when you talk about islands west east of Australia, you're talking about another belt of Chinese power projections as they assert themselves. But what's amazing to me, in spite of the Maritime Court ruling in favor of the Philippines, the Philippines does, it will, has said they will not, you know, and they're in Beijing this week, their president is. I believe it's Beijing where there's a summit going on. But he says he may or may not push that issue, that he's more interested in developing joint ventures with the Chinese in quote-unquote disputed waters. The Vietnamese have been told twice to stop drilling, and they have. And the Chinese are recommending that there are certain places that they could develop jointly, and they should both move forward enthusiastically and do that. So what essentially the Chinese have done, and now they're throwing a fit if the United States sails within 12 nautical miles of reefs they've claimed as their own and fortified, most recently putting jamming devices in there, and they're essentially locking up the South China Sea. And where is the pushback from the free democracies on the planet that says, no, that's an international shipping lane, right? There's an international court that's ruled against you. So you and the Vietnamese, you guys can bilaterally cut any deal you want. But that body of water and the rights to those natural resources in there by no means belong to you simply because you say it so. There is no pushback. And I find it, Grant, absolutely astounding. Now, maybe there isn't any because we're more fixated on North Korea. I don't know.
I think it's been, really since the Nixon era, it's been a concerted, sort of intentional policy of appeasement. They call it a different word because appeasement's not a polite word these days. But it has been to accommodate China in expectations that they will become like us. And they've shown no indication they want to, and why should they? But it has been, this is the logical outcome of successive U.S. administrations. So this is really not a surprise.
How many data points does the Thurston Howe, the third group that occupies the State Department, right? Those ascot wearing bozos, how many data points do you need before you can say that, you know what, Mr. Bush's premise has been invalidated? And China is turning this over on us. They, instead of them coming to us, they have their tentacles, and tentacles is a nice word. They have an ice pick at the end of a tentacle that they put through everybody's sternum, and they're yanking us all towards them and bending us to them. That would seem to be a more clear view of what China does. How many data points does the State Department need to say, yeah, we probably need to rethink that?
Apparently a limitless amount, but but it's not. Beyond the State Department, there really has been Wall Street. It's been most of American industry. It's been the CEOs of, say, little aviation companies that get an offer from the Chinese and sell out for the money. It's been most of Capitol Hill, and academia have all bought into this. So it's been a sort of a joint effort.
Right.
State Department deserves its blame, but it's not just, but it really has been just national insanity that's gone on almost half a century and finally waking up. But you do notice, however, as you noted, that we don't seem to have a consistent plan. Consistent approach. So, for example, we will do something like sail an aircraft carrier through the South China Sea, and then the next thing we do is we invite China to RIMPAC. One hardly knows what to say. And if you could name the senior military officers who have spoken up publicly about the sort of the lack of wisdom in doing this. Just the insanity that it's a very short list, and I can't think of anybody on it.
Certainly nobody notable, right?
No. You know, I had a friend who works for the government still, and he was commenting on this from sort of the civil end of it, that he commented that, you know, the State Department will demarche, that's complain to something formally, and to the, we'll debarsh the Chinese in the morning, and then we'll give a visa to a Chinese scientist and a grant in the afternoon. And that pretty much sums it up. You know, we've, instead of having a consistent policy to challenge China, or just more better said, to stand up for our interests, we have this passive-aggressive approach to the Chinese, which they take full advantage of, unless they think that we're so dumb that we have some, this, we're luring them into some clever trap. But they've probably figured
they
it out.
Yeah, them. They know better than that. I've got an email here, Mac. I saw this because I, like you, have been made smarter by listening to Grant and then pursuing on my own pleasure reading that winds up being not very pleasurable. I'm not sure that I would join you in thanking him for that, but I found this and I thought it is interesting because it does kind of quantify the extent that China's Belt and Road Initiative is reshaping the world and will continue to reshape it in the future. And the headline is, China's trillion-dollar Belt and Road Infrastructure Plan is reshaping global trade. And that is trillion. You heard that right. Trillion. They are going to devote $8 trillion, which is only, that what, 3 years' worth of the U.S. trade deficit with China. So you can thank yourself for paying for it. So it is. It's not a small initiative, eh, Grant?
It certainly isn't. They, and, you know, just, it's, in just sheer physical terms, it's impressive. You know, there's some good diagrams or maps that are out about it. You do have to, if you step back a bit, you have to admire it. There's a couple things that, when I'm thinking about this, is that, there's an impression that China is really unstoppable, that they've got this, they've got some system figured out that effectively gives them all the money in the world and they can buy and get whatever they want. But there's a couple things to consider. One is that China has, I'm not sure they have as much money as people think. And what I would point to is that for about the last 25 years, there's been this massive outflow of money from China. And specifically, anybody who can, anyone in China who can, puts their money into something fungible, or ideally keeps it as money, but gets it out of the country and gets it somewhere safe. This could be the United States, Singapore, Vancouver, London, those kind of, and Australia, those kind of places. And so what you have, and the amounts of this are just immense, and nobody has quite calculated it, but it's a lot. And what I would suggest, and this is worth considering, is that this is effectively a futures market where the people who are benefiting the most from the Chinese system are not sure enough about its future that they want to get their money out of the country. They ideally want to get a relative out with a green card so they can all come. They want a bolt hole in some safe place, which ironically is the West, their main enemies. And this is something that the Chinese government is scared to death about. But it is also, I think, suggests that they may not have all the money that people think. And financially, they're not as sound as it seems. But another thing to keep in mind is that you'll notice with the One Belt, One Road projects that how China is trying to drum up investors. It's trying to get foreign countries to join in this, to put their own money into these projects. And it has the sort of the air of a flimflam man, kind of, who's trying to get people to put their money in because he's not willing to. And if it was such a good deal, China would want to only use its own money. And that is something that should tip one off. So I'm not, you know, if we were smart and could actually, and I think there's some promise in the trade sanctions that have been put on recently, but if we could pressure the Chinese economy a bit, I think it would sputter and then it would start to have some problems. But we have done so little that it is it's kind of on a roll at the moment.
All right. That leads us directly to the Chinese and to the Japanese. And so I want to talk about them. You've written a piece, and we talked, last time you were on, we talked about J. Jay Whitlass and all the off years of doing Iron Fist and ultimately the fruition, and all of a sudden it's a ripple around the world. The Chinese activate their first Marine Corps since World War II.
The
Japanese do. And in fact, I did a little editorial over the weekend saying, I hope the Germans are paying attention. Because just as the Pacific needs a strong Japan, Europe needs a strong Germany, and instead of a freeloading Germany. And so, talk to us about, Japan is watching China. Japan dominated China and the region for hundreds of years, yes?
Not so much, just from about the late 1800s, actually. But they really did dominate it. It's really not been a centuries-long domination.
So I asked that to get a sense of, do the Chinese believe, for instance, for those of us who served in Al Anbar, the Sunnis, when you would interact with them, they would say, hey, we're on your side. You hate the Iranians, we hate the Iranians, right? The Shiites are Iran. When you look at the Shiites, that's what you should see. We are your natural ally, and we have dominated them. And if you will just get out of our way, you don't even have to help us, but don't restrain us. We will put this thing in order for you, and we will be your ally. But if you side with them, you get Iran. You embolden Iran. And that's what will happen. And it turns out they're right. But is the Japanese view of the Western Pacific, is it that they are the ascendant power and they will put things in order? Or is it not that way? I'm kind of curious about how they view the problem.
It's certainly not like that anymore. It was for, say, from the late 1800s on till about August 1945. And then after that, when Japan recovered economically after World War II, they did get a bit of hubris and saw themselves as going to be the leaders of Asia. They used to use the expression, if like a flock of geese, and Asia was the flock of geese, and they were the goose at the front, leading it. It wasn't really in a military sense, because that wasn't an issue, but it was more they were the economic power, and they were going to lead Asia. But they've gotten over that that's gone away. So it's not like a Sunni-Shia thing to that extent, although for a brief period, say late 1800s, 1945, it was. But that's a fairly short time. But other than that, the Japanese and the Chinese have kind of had a wary relationship, and are sometimes breaking into fighting, and then other times just this, say, a very sort of unsettled a relationship where neither side can admit the other is superior to the other. In fact, they can barely even admit, I don't think they can even admit each one is equal to the other. Now, the Japanese see themselves as superior culturally and just they're more civilized. As they see it, they don't spit for one thing, but
they don't.
Not on the street in public, but the Chinese, of course, it's just a given that they are superior to the dwarfs that they often refer to the Japanese as. So it's different than the Arab, the Middle Eastern dynamic, but it is what I think the important thing is that it's very hard for the Chinese and the Japanese to reach some sort of an accommodation, especially when China sees itself as ascendant, as on the way up. And is willing to use its military to really sort of avenge these old insults and the problems Japan caused it over the last, in recent history. And then the Japanese are just really scared to death of being swamped by the Chinese. And so that's kind of the dynamic. And I don't see it resolving itself. I think the best you can hope for is an uneasy accommodation where both sides agree not to bother each other too much, but unfortunately, the Chinese are going to increase pressure in the East China Sea in particular, but also elsewhere in Asia, all with an eye to really surrounding or keeping Japan in check, or better, sort of having your hands on its throat so you can apply pressure as you need to make sure they cooperate. And there's not much, and Japan is in a difficult position, but setting up this new Marine Brigade the other day is at least a sign that Japan is not willing to roll over. I think it's some grounds for optimism, but in the larger context, that alone isn't enough, but one step at a time.
So does Japan watch events that occur to the south in the South China Sea and say that is coming to a theater near us? That will be us soon. We will be going down this road. And the Chinese simply, you know, they remind me of Stalin when Stalin was asked, do you worry about what the Pope says? And Stalin's reply was, how many divisions does the Pope have? And so the ruling relative to Chinese disputes over the nine dash line with the Philippines, the Chinese, they just brushed it aside. Yeah, we don't care. What does that have to do with anything? Do the Japanese see that and see their future?
It depends, like a lot of things, depends on which Japanese you're talking about. Okay. And so it's a little hard to characterize, but I will anyway. Within the political world in Japan, you have a fairly large number of politicians who are just craven appeasers. And just a little hyperbole, one, there's some suspicions of just how successful Chinese subversion, political warfare, bribery has been with some of the Japanese political world. And even in the media and academia, there's a very appeasing bent towards China. However, you do find politicians who are very worried about Chinese encroachment, Chinese sort of getting stronger. And in the military, that's probably where you've had the longest awareness of the Chinese threat. And they've been aware of that for a long time. I would suggest even longer than the United States military has been willing to admit it. And the Japanese just always point this out. I mean, going back to the early 2000s and before, just of the what was coming from China, but on the U.S. side, nobody chose to take that seriously. But you do have also within, I'd say, the Japanese political world, the officialdom, and parts of the media as well, and that there is a good sense. There's always been a real awareness of what the threat is. And what I point to is that you'll notice that Japan has these amphibious ships that they call helicopter carriers. It's like a helicopter destroyers, which is allegedly just a destroyer with a lot of helicopters on it to go do anti-submarine warfare. Yet these are amphibious ships, and the newer ones are, you can use them as platforms for, say, the F-35B. This didn't come about by accident or spring from the ground fully formed. So there's always been Japanese who knew what needed done and have quietly been trying to do it. And that's why you do have a Japanese self-defense force, which is sizable. It has good equipment, and it is, if it can organize itself right, it is capable of hurting somebody. Not really in a strategic offense, but only in a strategic defense. So Japan has developed what is a powerful military. It doesn't live up to its potential yet, but it shows that within the Japanese government, within the society, that there are people who are aware of the threats facing Japan and who want to do something about it. But like any free society, it has differing factions and different views of things. So it's tension between really appeasement, fake pacifism, free riding on the Americans, and then Japanese who see that it needs a coherent, powerful defense to defend itself. So we're seeing, you can see some of each if you look in the right way, but I think you're seeing more of the Japan must defend itself thinking coming to the fore.
The My guest this morning, very graciously, Grant Newsham, as he does. So let's talk about, so what is next? I think that for those of us in the American military, it was a bit of an epiphany that a helicopter carrier isn't such a benign presence anymore when it has a squadron or a detachment of F-35 Charlies on it. It is not the same as it was when it had the very limited AV-8B. It becomes a different kind of a circle, one that should be accounted for. What is next, given what you've said about the Japanese, what's the next step? Because that story was big headlines around the world. And it was, you know, and again, it was pointed specifically at one nation, and that is the Chinese.
Yeah, but it's also, it's important to keep it. There's a couple ways, important things, I think, to take from this. And one is that this is the first time in a long time that I really can't think of the previous example, where you have the Japanese ground self-defense force, or even the Japanese self-defense force, on display for the public, for the media, and what they're talking about doing with this new unit is fighting. There's no talk of HADR operations. There's no talk of building statues in the Hokkaido Snow Festival, as the GSDF has traditionally thrived at, but rather talking about fighting and killing. And that's this is unusual. See, I can't think of another example of it. And is a useful thing to give to hint that Japan is not going to roll over necessarily. And that was something worth keeping in mind. But also the scale of this new amphibious brigade is worth considering. When it's at full size in early 2000s, or 2020s, it'll be about maybe 2,300 troops, roughly. And so it will have the capability of landing about 600 or 700 Japanese Marines somewhere. Now, 600 or 700 people, if you put them into, say, Petco Stadium, it would look empty. I mean, it would look empty. So that's not a lot of people. You could land them in Shanghai and nobody would notice. They would simply disappear. So the point is that in terms of scale, this is not a threat to anybody, but it is very useful potentially for defending Japanese territory, done right. But it also suggests that the Japanese Army and the Japanese Navy, and perhaps someday the Air Force, are going to cooperate with each other. And if Japan does that, then its military gets better. So it's kind of that was part of the reason why we pushed for an amphibious force, was to force the Japanese services to cooperate. So it could be, you know, you're setting an example that cooperation isn't bad, and it's a good thing, and perhaps it will spread more quickly. But in terms of, so the Chinese have been claiming that the amphibious brigade is a threat, a sign of Japanese militarism, etc. It's not. As I said, 600-700 people is not a lot of people to land somewhere. In the meantime, China is putting together a 100,000-man Marine Corps. They've already got one, about 20,000, but they're just going to make it bigger. And the stated intention is to use this Marine Corps overseas. The new Chinese base in Djibouti can handle 10,000 troops. And that's what's coming. So for all the complaining the Chinese do, they really ought to be quiet. But it would be nice if people would point this stuff out. So one, it shows us a sense that Japan is sort of waking up. It's got a long way to go. And so the brigade is a good thing in that sense. But in the broader regional context, the Chinese sort of onslaught is so widespread and all-encompassing almost, that this is it's not going to stop the tide, and the only solution to that really is to, at least militarily, is for the Japanese to get as close to the Americans as they can. So if this new brigade and the Japanese Navy ships that work with it, if these link in, fully integrate, fully link in with the Americans and start exercising and patrolling in the East China Sea west of Okinawa, down by the Senkaku Islands, then that'll be a change of, have changed the game somewhat, and that'd be a good thing to see.
Can you explain why the free nations of the planet haven't done more in terms of, is it the conundrum that the Chinese pose to everybody relative to the way they've weaponized their economy? So we're going to dangle this all this demand for your products and your T-shirts that you make in the Philippines and whatever else you make in the Philippines, we will consume that like no economy on the planet will consume that. All boats will rise. Is it that conundrum that? But in return for that, you're going to have to dance with the devil a little bit. Is it that conundrum that it poses for free nations, to include the United States? And you said we're no different than anybody else. You know, are the CEOs of any major corporation look at China and say that is where the growth is going to come from here in the next millennium? So if I don't develop that, if I don't actively develop that, then I'm not, and if I don't pressure the United States to create trade policies that facilitate that, I'm going to lose my job, because that is certainly where it is. Is that the conundrum? The Chinese have almost, I dare say, they're using our own greed against us to develop Chinese economic and military power without, as a commandant said recently, the Chinese aim to win without firing a shot?
It's some of that, and that's a lot of it, to my way of thinking. The just when this started with Nixon and Kissinger, the idea actually was to use the Chinese as a way to, by sort of us getting closer to them, to put the Russians at a disadvantage. And this was considered really brilliant strategery and statecraft. and to the point of giving, and this continued under the Carter and Reagan administrations, actually providing the Chinese with some advanced military technology, such as torpedo technology. I'm not making this up, and actually trying to improve their military so they would be able to take on the Russians better. And this was going to give the Americans an advantage, supposedly. I'll leave it at that. But it started off actually as a way to disadvantage the Russians. And how dumb can you be? But if that continued beyond, as I said, through the Reagan administration. But it really ultimately, I think, it comes down to what you've described, and that is money. And the idea of selling one of something to every Chinese person has been around for a long time. Even back in the 19th century, the mill owners in England talked of just getting every Chinaman to extend the length of his robe by about a foot, and that would, you know, make everybody rich as Croesus. So this is nothing new, and it is that belief that you're going to make sort of untold wealth from the China market. And sometimes you do in the short term, but over the long term, it's a much different thing in most cases. And I would kind of describe it, to my way of thinking, that it all started out, there was a very condescending approach towards the Chinese, towards China, on the part of the American elite, the American business community, and a sense that, well, we'll always be ahead of the Chinese, so we can give any concessions, and, you know, if they demand technology, sure, we'll always be ahead. It was a condescending approach, and even the military had it towards the PLA, towards the Chinese, that, well, yeah, we're the Americans. We're the most powerful country, the most powerful military by far, so we can Yeah, we'll deal with the Chinese. No big problem. No problem. You know, we'll invite them to RIMPAC. You know, we'll have these engagements, etc. We'll invite them to visit. One Navy admiral actually offered to help them develop aircraft carriers. He remains unnamed, however. But there's been this condescension. But when you throw in money into the mix, it does tend to make people go insane, and particularly Westerners. And so I would suggest that there's like a road that goes from being condescending to craven. And so that once the Chinese actually got pretty good militarily, once they got good economically, and they do have it's pretty, compared to what it was, and by any measure, it's a substantial economy. And if you still think you can get money out of that, even though you're now at a disadvantage, well, if you can personally get some money in the short term, that it's easy to go from condescending to just cravenness and do anything for money. And that's about where we've gotten. We're showing some slight signs of waking up, but it is really late in the day.
I've got an email. Mac, I'm fascinated by the way China has turned this thing upside down on us. And I believe Grant's absolutely right. A condescending, sleeping Western power then begins to wake up, but it is constantly undercut by the CEOs of its major corporations that desperately need and want to do business there. What a perfect cocktail. The Chinese must laugh their ass off when they talk about the way we respond to this. I'm curious about the One Belt, One Road geography. Where do these belts and roads go? I'm a bit familiar with the old Silk Roads. Are these similar? Grant, can you off the top of your head kind of walk us through, when we talk about belts and the Belt and Road, where are they putting infrastructure? What are they trying to open up?
I think it might be accurate enough, at least this is how I conceptualize it, is that from the Chinese perspective, the idea is to get a reasonable sort of set of transport routes by land, by sea, that get from China to Europe. I always call it a branch of it that goes off from China down into Southeast Asia. You know, so that you're going to have a railway eventually that goes from Kunming in southern China all the way down to Singapore, for example.
So I
look at it as from China to Europe and then China down into Southeast Asia as where these transportation routes are in process of being worked out. And it's the connection to this alleged Silk Road in the past that is tenuous, but you know, Chinese history is what it is, and they make it up. But for what we have today is that I think it is the idea is to go to Europe and down to Southeast Asia. And if you look at where the railways are being put in, the ports are being built or refurbished, that they, you know, are making, it's not like you're starting in like at one point and just going in a straight line or going till you get where you get to Europe. Rather, they kind of hopscotch and leapfrog, and it's being created in sort of pieces almost, and maybe eventually it'll come together in some way. So that's how I would tend to look at it. Some people jokingly refer to it as one belt, one road, one way. The idea is that it's the only intention here is to sell Chinese stuff to everybody. It's not really intended to be a two-way, equal sort of trading relationship. And I think that's fair to say. The Chinese simply are not interested in buying anything they don't have to. And say, you'd mentioned that the craven CEOs, what the mindset there is you only have to sell enough in the short term to get yourself your bonus. But look at the long-term perspective. And I would cite Boeing as a classic example of this. unfortunately. And, you know, Boeing is a huge, great company, and they are very opposed to President Trump's use of trade sanctions, trade weapons, or pressure on the economic front against China, because there's all these airplanes that Boeing is going to sell to China, and they've got, you know, they could sell quite a few over, say, the next 20, 30 years. After that, what happens once Chinese competition gets into the market and starts making planes that are about as good, a lot cheaper, subsidized by the government? What happens then? But nobody looks out 30 years. I have never seen anybody from the Boeing end of things actually deliver a clear long-term forecast along those lines. It's worth considering that there are parts of the aviation market, sort of the shorter range domestic market in China, that Boeing doesn't even bother with. And yet McDonnell Douglas, nobody quite remembers this, was there 20 plus years ago, set up a manufacturing plant to make, I think it was the MD-80. And the Chinese basically just figured out how to build an MD-80, whatever technology was not given to them, they stole. And now Chinese aircraft effectively control that slice of the market. And Boeing doesn't even bother with it in China. Now, nobody ever talks about that much, but it gives you a pretty good sense of what is coming. If you are a CEO whose business is dependent on technology, as over time, China will build up the competition and will put you, and you will then have a rival. Who's a fierce rival and potentially puts you out of business, as happened to Motorola in China, which I know because I work for them. But that's a very long answer to the question. But I think of China to Europe, China down to Southeast Asia is one way to look at the One Belt, One Road. And also it's not so much not sequentially, but rather is done where opportunity allows. And they have had some good success. In some places, one I would point to is to show how you can jump around is the port of Piraeus, which is the port of Athens. China has got that. They have the management rights to it. They actually got them probably almost 10 years ago, but it's more recently and it's been publicized more. But that gives you access to the EU. It gives you a major port in right in Europe. So now there's all this stuff in between Europe and China, and it's just a question of filling that in, assuming that nothing disrupts that. And things do happen, so I wouldn't rule out disruption.
If you do a search on China One Belt, One Road map, you will come up with a whole series of maps that are very interesting. They come from Wall Street Journal, they come from the Chinese government, all kinds of different maps, images, and you can see, as Grant says, there are multiple efforts. There's a northern corridor that runs through Kiev, Moscow, Minsk, Warsaw, Berlin, and then out to the coast in the Northern Sea. There's a central corridor that branches out and feeds into the northern corridor. The central corridor branches off and goes through Greece, goes through Istanbul, Greece, goes through Iran, and then there's a southern corridor. So you see all these different efforts that China is making, and again, $1 trillion that they are shopping around the world in order to access the EU, in order to access Europe, and in order to change their dependence on their own eastern seaboard and the Pacific. So pretty interesting stuff. Is there a tipping point? Final question, I'll let you go. Is there a tipping point that tips, and it seems like we're living this dual existence with both of our major alliances, in our Pacific alliance and our European alliance, that is there going to be a tipping point where we will all hang together, or surely we will all hang separately? Or do you see, as Xi has done here in the last 24 hours, saying that there's no need to revert to a Cold War mentality, that China is more than willing to open up its markets to American products. Do you see China being able to coexist, or do you see at some point that the free democracies of the world will have to look and say, you know what, we need to be able to deal with China firmly, and China needs to, you know, needs to agree to play by the rules, open sea lanes, and things like that. How do you see it going forward, Grant?
Well, I could see it going either of at least two ways, and one of them I could actually see us sort of, slouching off into Chinese domination, into a world where Chinese genuinely do dominate things. They're economically, militarily, and it's, you know, to the point where we're just not up for the fight. You know, it's not worth, you know, give up with it. And I could see that happening. I could see it happening because the Chinese threat is so much different. It appears different than the Russian threat. I think it's actually far more serious.
Right.
But I could almost see us just sort of, just out of almost disinterest, like a cat sleeping in the sun, just kind of doesn't really want to rouse himself. And the people who are sort of yelling about this, they get ignored, actually. They don't really get criticized as much. It's just ignored by the elite that decides how the business and the government elites. So I'm not so sure. We just might not gradually fade off the way, say, the Austrians did or the way the British did, which is really a no-account country now in terms of global issues. I don't want to be mean.
I think it's really just felt like a really
interesting Disneyland kind of, but it really has no influence. I could see us ending up that way if we're not careful. But on the other hand, I think China has a tendency to overreach and sort of do one thing too many, and I could see them doing that to the point it finally rouses us. You know, just the way bin Laden did one thing too many. And that we do have a way of waking up at the last minute, and then we do very well. And I could see that happening. China is like the fat man at the buffet who sees this tray of eclairs and has to have them all for himself. And they're going to do something, I think, that wakes us up. And it could involve, sinking a U.S. ship, killing some Americans somewhere, or doing something to the Japanese, which, assuming we're still friends with them, would get us to stand up and finally say enough's enough. So which one will it be? Boy, I don't know, but I would be inclined. I don't know if I would give better than 50% odds for either one of them. It maybe depends on what time of day you ask me.
I was going to say that, and we all have to keep in mind that he does predict that the Redskins will win the Super Bowl on an annual basis. So with that in mind, at some point you've got to be right about most all of this. Interesting stuff. I don't know that, in my opinion, I don't know in terms of geopolitical events, there's a more fascinating part of the world now, a more dynamic part of the world, And a part of the world that will become more and more important by leaps and bounds than the Western Pacific, and the changing dynamic with China and the way it's spreading itself around the world. So I appreciate your mentorship in all of these things, and thank you very much for getting up early and joining us.
Okay, my pleasure. Anytime. Always glad to weigh in.
All right, Grant. Thank you.
Right, Charles. Okay, out here. All right.
There, that is Grant Newsham here. On a, I will tell you again. His discussions that he has are fascinating and have kind of teased me to read more. And when you see that, and then you read current events and you see the implementation of that, it's honestly, it's pretty amazing. Absolutely amazing. You know, if you look at maps, you're going to see a Silk Road, which goes back to the old ancient Chinese trade routes, you know, Marco Polo and all that craziness, right? And so you'll see that, and you'll see a maritime Silk Road that comes that goes down the eastern coast, goes, and that's why it's essential that they dominate the Malaccan Straits. It's essential that they dominate the South China Sea, and then it goes through the Indian Ocean to Nairobi, to Kenya's capital. Up the coast of Africa through the Suez Canal, and into the Mediterranean, and into Greece, and into ports in Italy, and into Europe. And so that's the maritime road, and that's where China's investing. So building rail lines through India, building rail lines through Pakistan, building rail lines through Bangladesh, all of it to gain access to open trade, as well as the overland route that goes from China, again, through places like Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, right? Yeah, through the stands, right? Through Pakistan. So, again, all of that means money to those countries that historically have been ignored. But you have to dance with China. And they are, and then, look, they're under, most of them are under no illusion about that. So anyway, my thanks to Grant. To me, the conversation is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. We'll take a break. More of All Marine Radio coming up next, right here on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. Michael Musselman, next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.